Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, let's start right in with the fall vaccine guide, and we are having information wars about vaccines. But essentially, the Vaccine Advisory Committee from the CDC usually every year issues issues guidance. But in March, a federal judge put out an injunction that Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr. unlawfully altered vaccine policy and improperly fired the group and then reconstituted with, let's say, people with a slightly different reality basis than the rest of us, certainly the rest of the physicians. So the major medical societies have gotten together to provide comprehensive recommendations, short list, American Academy of Family Physicians, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, Infectious Disease Society of America. They all got together, guided by an independent review that was conducted by the Vaccine Integrity Project in collaboration with the American Medical Association. And the VIP was a bunch of public health researchers who essentially went through hundreds of peer-reviewed studies on safety and effectiveness of immunizations against influenza, COVID-19, and RSV, and found no new safety concerns, which was apparently one of the assertions, I think would be a better word, that was made back in March. We'll move on to just talking about what those recommendations are. Let's start with, when's the best time to get the flu shot? Well, we're getting there. You should think about having it done in October. I used to say by the time you start seeing Halloween decorations in stores, but that happened around the 4th of July this year, so that's no longer a rule. But, you know, when it gets to October, that's the time to go get a flu shot. You're going to get your big peak of antibodies around Thanksgiving. And Thanksgiving is when we do the major mixing and matching with our younger Petri dish relatives, and so that's when older people in particular are likely to catch it, as well as middle-aged and younger people. As far as COVID vaccines concerned, let's go over that again. Annual COVID vaccine is recommended. There is now an updated version available. You could get it now or you could get it later this fall. If you've had COVID recently, you should wait 4 to 6 months before getting vaccinated. That is because right now your antibodies are going to actually attenuate the vaccine potentially because they're going to be circulating. They're going to grab all of the spike protein that the vaccine has you make before it has a chance to actually spike the immune system. So if you get it earlier, it's not harmful. It is a theoretical idea that maybe it won't be as strong. You can safely take COVID-19, flu, and RSV at the same visit. The pharmacies really pressure you to do that. For pregnant women, that they can also be given together. Giving the vaccines together does not reduce their effectiveness. I agree with that. I do want to emphasize, if you are a senior and you are frail, okay? So frail means a lot of things, but I think we all know it when we see it. If you are, you know, walking 3 or 4 miles and doing a lot of gardening, you're probably not frail. If you're getting through your day, but not much else, and you wouldn't be able to walk a mile, you might want to get the extra strength flu vaccine, the high dose flu vaccine. I am not a fan of the adjuvanted version of the flu vaccine because I think, especially if you take it with the COVID vaccine and the RSV vaccine, altogether, you're probably going to spend the next 24 to 36 hours kind of achy and tired. And, you know, you don't need to put yourself through that unless you're getting on an airplane to go visit grandchildren, in which case, yeah, you should probably have done that last week. But certainly at least 2 weeks before you make the trip, if possible, if you're going to be visiting young ones. It's time to start thinking about that. You only need one RSV vaccine. If you had it last year, you really don't need to repeat it. It does not do the same kind of drift as the flu vaccine does. Now, as far as pregnant women are concerned, just stay away from the nasal spray. That's the only thing you need to know. The newest mRNA flu vaccine, which just got approved, is not recommended for pregnant women, not because we think it's dangerous, but because we have no data, because it's brand new. So it is not going to be recommended until we get a little bit more data on that. It's really important to understand and talk to young women in your family who are pregnant, because there are basically three groups of people who die from COVID anymore. And the people who die are pregnant people, babies, and grandparents. So if you fit into one of those three groups, you probably should get your COVID vaccine. And, you know, should you get a second one in 6 months? I think, again, that depends on your level of frailty. And the recommendations are, there's a little bit of drift between the these recommendations and the FDA-approved populations. Most of the people can get these shots off-label, and generally they are paid for by insurance, who obviously, given what it costs to spend one night in the hospital, the, you know, $30 or $40 that they pay for the vaccine is chump change and not worth worrying about. Who should get RSV? And this is an important one. If you are pregnant, you want to try to get the RSV between 32 and 36 weeks during RSV season, which is extended all the way to March. So basically fall through March is RSV prime time. And you want the mother to have the antibodies. So if you take it at 36 weeks and you deliver it 40 weeks, you have your antibodies are ramping up by if you get it to 32 weeks, you're peaking at birth, and that's going to protect the infant. And we also are recommending RSV for infants younger than 8 months, as if they're going into their first RSV season and their mother wasn't vaccinated. Children over 8 months, you don't give a second RSV unless those children are immunosuppressed or they have something wrong with their health, and then you can look at the specific recommendations. One-time RSV for all adults 75 and older, and if you're between 50 and 74 and you're at increased risk, say you have chronic asthma, you have COPD, you're a long-term smoker, those are the people who you want to really get that vaccine. And I want to take a moment and talk about measles. And we're going to talk about measles, the disease, okay? We're not going to talk about measles, the political issue, or measles, the religious issue. We are going to talk about the most infectious disease there is. It's so infectious that being on the same bus for a couple of blocks is enough. Getting on the carnival ride after the person with measles has been on the ride, getting in the taxi is after the person with measles holding or the person holding the child with measles is enough to get measles. And measles in unvaccinated individuals can be deadly. A lot of times it's babies that haven't gotten the vaccine yet because it doesn't work until you're about 15 months old. They give it at 12 months. It sort of works then, but it really doesn't work that well until you're a little bit older. And that's just the way it is. If the mother's not been vaccinated, consult the public health department, because then there's no maternal antibody, and measles is really a very significant killer of infants in countries where infants are largely unvaccinated. We have seen this disease for a very, very long time, and it is it just wants to kill us, and it's easy to catch. There are big clusters of measles right now. There's a major cluster in Philadelphia, and there's basically an argument about whether they died of measles or died with measles. And it's like a, it's like, come on, guys. If you have if you're a child and you get measles and you die, the measles killed you. Okay, whether it caused measles pneumonia or it caused measles encephalitis. Plus, and this is the big like thing that nobody seems to get, there is this systemic sclerosing encephalopathy that people can get 10 or 20 or 40 years where their immune system eats their brain, basically, trying to, and it's only seen in people who have survived measles. So not getting measles is a really, really good idea. This is a rare, but this is a nasty disease, and it's like Huntington's level brain destruction, and why are we even risking that for anybody? The vaccine is safe. Measles is unsafe. 30% of the cases that have happened in the outbreaks this year are in adults, 30%. So there's been years of under-vaccination in certain communities. This goes back, gosh, we've been having this discussion in functional medicine circles at least for 20 years. I'm thinking about all the kids who are now having kids who aren't vaccinated. That one we really, really can't fix, because you can't vaccinate the mother while she's pregnant, because this is a live vaccine. So you would potentially give measles to the baby. So if the mother's not vaccinated before she gets pregnant, then you've got this time window of a year where if the infant is exposed to measles, they could die. And it's not even that unlikely. The death rate from measles prior to vaccination was 1 in 5,000 cases. 1 in 5,000 cases is a very, very big number. So let's get real. Measles is the menace, not the vaccine. The drug that beats statins. Okay. This particular story is about the first PCSK9 blocker or inhibitor, which is called enlicitide. Not elicitide, although that wouldn't be a bad drug name either, enlicitide, and the current brand name, Lipfendra, which is, I don't know, focus group failure, if you ask me. Anyway, it blocks PCSK9, which is going to really drop LDL. It basically prevents the body from producing LDL, and it's oral. There's a wonderful injection that costs $600 a month and isn't covered by insurance that blocks PCSK9. This is half the price and is effective. Only costs $315 a month. But for people who have had, and this is who needs this drug, it's people who have had a heart attack or a heart attack equivalent, like they've gotten stented and they haven't damaged any myocardium. You've got the disease, and if you've got the disease and you can't take statin agents, or statin agents are not bringing it down enough to get you into the safety zone, this is the situation where Dr. Don would recommend a drug. And if you're that person, your doctor can go through a prior authorization process and submit documentation, and you know they'll probably cover it. And with a lot of effort, you will definitely get it covered because you have the disease. This is not a preventative agent at this point. This is a treatment agent, and that's a very important distinction. So, again, enlicitide is the agent, and I don't have dosing on it. It is brand new, but coming to a cardiology office near you, and certainly worth looking at if you fit the criteria. Speaking of fitting the criteria, let's talk a moment about screening criteria. Yeah, so screening criteria for diseases are based on epidemiology. They're based on the frequency of the disease. There's, you know, the incidence, which is how many people get it per year, and the amount of cases that are out there. So you have how many people have cancer. It's going to be a larger number than how many people got cancer this year. But cancer is what we're going to be talking about, because cancer rates are rising among younger adults. And a recent study just published indicated that men, younger men, are more likely than same-age women to be diagnosed at a later stage for 20 different types of cancers. And these include stomach, lung, tongue, and some throat cancers. And when I see those, I'm basically thinking smoking, whether it's cigarettes or cannabis, and drinking spirits, because we know those are really hard on those tissues. And I would be betting that if we looked at the incidence of those in utilization patterns, men would be topping women on those. I know that for the tongue and oral cancers in particular, the use of smokeless tobacco does not provide any protection and, in fact, provides some increased risk. So several experts, including the American Cancer Society, have changed their recommendations for these normally done screening tests. Cervical cancer screening starting at the age of 25 for women, and this is regardless of vaccination status. So this is the first time I've seen like a really specific recommendation that is assuming that women have been vaccinated against the human papillomavirus. I want to emphasize, if you have not been vaccinated against the human papillomavirus, then cervical cancer screening really needs to start within 2 years after first intercourse. And that is the old recommendation that got completely blown out of the water by the vaccine. This is an example of a vaccine against cancer that has drastically reduced the incidence of cervical cancer in women in the United States in a generation. Getting a pap smear, starting usually somewhere between 15 and 20, was a rite of passage, and annual pap smears for women was maybe, I think, one of the reasons that women did better in terms of their health care, because they were actually having to go to the doctor once a year. And I don't think that young men did that. In fact, I know they didn't. So that will be interesting to see if that difference in cancer rates between men and women is at least partially due to those pap smears. Anyway, colorectal cancer starting, that's basically a poop test. You test the poop for human blood. If you find human blood, then presumably it's coming from the person, and that's the screening. If you screen out positive, then it's a look-see, periscope, and look around, colonoscopy. Breast cancer screening in the form of annual mammograms also has come down. So annual between the ages of 45 and 54, and at least once every 2 years afterwards. This is also a new recommendation, bringing that age down. Lung cancer screening starting at age 50 for people who meet certain criteria. We'll cover that in a minute. And prostate cancer, the pendulum has swung back to getting a PSA starting at age 50. There's still debate around that. And, you know, your poor primary care doctor who is totally time crunched and has like 18 boxes to check on a wellness visit is now going to have a meaningful discussion about risk and benefit, about the side effects of getting a PSA. More than likely, the doctor's just going to check the box and order the PSA now, which at least for younger men is probably a good idea, because we are also seeing prostate cancer in younger men. And again, we don't know why. Now, that lung cancer screening, that's a little complex. There's the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommends the screening for people between 50 and 80 years old who have a history of heavy smoking, either actively or in the past 15 years. And they're recommending a single low-dose CT scan. It's low-dose radiation, and it's usually covered by insurance. Heavy smoking is a pack a day. So if you were a one or two cigarettes on Friday nights, you would have to lie about your smoking frequency to get this test. Might not be a bad idea anyway. But there has been this test is not being done. It's not happening. And again, I look at it as doctors not having time necessarily to do all of these things. This is somewhere where AI may actually be helpful, because I could see having a screening visit on prevention that would be with a nice artificial human who would go over all of this and have a conversation with you. And now we've got technology that would do that, and that would be, you know, you could answer the person's questions about the testing, about the potential risks and benefits. You could show them charts. You could educate them, and it would all be done essentially for the patient's benefit so that they followed through on the screening, and for the system's benefit so that we catch the cancers earlier. That same task force, however, overemphasizes the potential risks of false positive PSAs, which will require additional testing and possible prostate biopsy. I am going to call them out on this, because we now routinely do MRI of the prostate and we look for suspicious lesions, and we now are doing prostate biopsies differently. We're not going through the rectum anymore. And that has drastically reduced the infection rates. So now the testing complications have dropped, and the technology to reduce the need for unnecessary biopsies has dropped. And so I believe that this recommendation, which goes back 8 years, it was from 2018, will be updated. And I want to point out that because the doctors were being good doctors and following the recommendations, the President of the United States, who was getting really good medical care, state-of-the-art medical care, all up to date on the recommendations from top-notch physicians, did not get his prostate cancer found because he was older than 70, so they stopped testing him. And I look at that as, you know, that's a serious egg on the face of that recommendation. It just is. And what's more important, it's a kinder, gentler procedure if you do test positive. So the arguments against testing have been substantially weakened by the movements forward in technology. So what's going on with these increased rates? We don't know. One thing that's important for people who have of the male gender, given those oral cancer risks, is get your dental checkups, because somebody needs to look in your mouth and look for white spots. And if you have a white spot in your mouth, a good thing to do, and this is just a home test, if you've got a white spot and you don't know how long it's been there, these white spots are not tender. So you can take a little vinegar on a Q-tip, just plain old white vinegar, apple cider vinegar, red wine vinegar, doesn't matter. Saturate a Q-tip, hold it to the spot, and if the spot gets whiter, get seen, okay? If it doesn't sting and it gets whiter, you should worry. If it stings, then you don't need to worry. Sorry, just rinse it off. But if it doesn't sting and it gets lighter after you hold that Q-tip on there for about 30 seconds, that's one that makes me worried about that human papillomavirus-induced oral cancer. We're going to talk about Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's disease is a very, very slow-moving disease. We've long thought of it as just a movement disorder, But now we see it as a protein storage problem, misfolded protein essentially clogging up the works in various tissues until it finally clogs up the works in such a distinctive way that we're able to make the diagnosis. And that distinctive way I'm talking about is something called a resting tremor. So this is usually the hand, but it can be the foot, and it's a rhythmic shaking of a body part when it rests, and it goes away when you activate that. So it's the opposite of a benign tremor, and a benign tremor, the hand is still at rest, but as you reach out to grab a coffee cup and bring it to your mouth, you get a little vibratory or maybe a lot vibratory. That's benign tremor. And it runs in families, but it can also be the result of overindulgence. And overindulgence in alcohol, very common, but also we'll see it with overindulgence of stimulants. But there's a whole side of Parkinson's that's non-motor. And so Parkinson's is very common. You're looking at 25 million cases in the world by 2050. And about 10% are inherited. A certain percentage are probably due to exposure to lead or other compounds. Agent Orange is on the list of things causing as a causative or trigger for Parkinson's. But there are common non-motor symptoms that we're going to talk about, which are going to overlap with a lot of other disorders. And this is called the prodromal phase. And it marks the beginning of the gradual onset of this disease. So it's decades, literally, between the first, the time that the misfolded alpha-synuclein starts to accumulate, and then eventually when it builds up high enough to cause a die-off of cells in the substantia nigra, which is a part of the brain that controls movement and coordination of the muscles in the brain. By the time the motor symptoms, that is to say the tremor, shows up, at least half of the neurons in the substantia nigra have already died. So finding it early and addressing it early are very important. So four early symptoms: loss of the sense of smell. Now, of course, we see that with COVID, and we see that with allergies. And so I see lots of people with a loss of sense of smell. Head trauma is another one, particularly if it's a helmet blow to the head, where you basically get hit in the front. It's a contre coup, so you get hit in the front and you damage the back. If you get hit in the back, it throws your head forward into the helmet. Your brain is thrown forward into the front of your skull. And so that can damage the olfactory bulb. 90% of people with Parkinson's disease lose their sense of smell over a long period, as much as 20 years before the disease is diagnosed. So just statistically, if you lose your sense of smell for more than a year and it's not coming back, you have a fivefold or a 500% higher risk of developing Parkinson's sometime in the future. And it's very easy to not realize it's happened. It may be that the protein is building up in the olfactory bulb. That, I think, is the most logical explanation. And if you are 40 years or older, I did not know this, little known fact, very useful fact. If you're 40 years or older in the United States and you've not been diagnosed with Parkinson's, you can request a free scratch and sniff smell test card from the Michael J. Fox Foundation. I have these in my office. I use them when I do my physicals for my patients. We'll do a scratch and sniff, usually every couple of years. In patients who have a family history, I'm doing it every year. And we'll get to why that is going to become, I think, a more universalized thing in medicine, because we now have some early diagnostic tools, which I'll tell you about at the end of this discussion. So if you've lost your sense of smell, it says, okay, increased risk. It doesn't mean you will. Probably the most interesting and scary symptom to develop is something called rapid eye movement sleep disorder. This is called sleep behavior disorder, or REM sleep behavior disorder, and it's a chronic condition. But what's going on here is when you sleep, you're supposed to go into a complete total paralysis during REM sleep, and that prevents you from acting out your dreams. People who don't have that paralysis will sit up in bed, they'll have one-sided conversations, and one that I hear about and have heard about over the years from wives in husbands who subsequently developed Parkinson's is they'll get kicked sometimes at night by their husband. But this is the big marker. If you have this, you need to get tested. And again, I'll talk about that testing later. But 50 to 70% of people with REM sleep behavior disorder will develop Parkinson's disease or Lewy body dementia, which is basically accumulations in different areas in the brain of the same toxic protein, within a timeline or of 5 to 10 years. And if you're over 50 and you have this sleep behavior disorder, the risk is 130 times. That would work out to 1,300% more. So, way more than double. Really important that we identify those individuals and get them tested. Now, one that is just common as dirt, and that's constipation. It does affect... Prolonged constipation affects two-thirds of all peoples with Parkinson's. And we're starting to wonder whether having constipation when you're young, like your 20s and 30s, gives you an increased chance of Parkinson's 40 years later. Now, since we also know that you can pick up this protein, alpha-synuclein, in the gut, the question, and in higher levels in people with Parkinson's, now that may be their body trying to get rid of it, but is that protein being made in the gut by a microbiome? Is there a microbiome profile, a particular species that's making misfolded alpha-synuclein? This is, you know, being actively researched because the association is there, the correlation is there. The question is, well, what's the direction of causality, right? Is the Parkinson's causing the alpha-synuclein in the gut, or is the alpha-synuclein in the gut causing the Parkinson's? Or is there a third variable causing both? It's such fun when you're trying to figure things out. One more symptom is orthostatic hypotension. This is getting dizzy from lying down to standing. This is normal if you've been lying down for 2 or 3 days with the flu. It's not unusual if you're dehydrated, if you're overheating, if you have a low blood sugar. But if it's all the time, then you have to worry that you already have one of the prodromal symptoms. So it's not that strong an indicator. Lots other aging conditions will lead to this. So the risk factor, orthostatic hypotension unexplained by other causes, was seen in 23% of patients after a 10-year follow-up. So worth looking at, but how do you look at it, right? Well, we now have three tests to talk about. There is an excellent test. It's called alpha-synuclein seed amplifier assay, and it is a CSF assay, so it requires a spinal tap. So not to be done lightly, but definitely legitimate to go after if you're in that REM sleep disorder category. There's also a skin biopsy, you know, the little punch biopsy that can look for the alpha-synuclein protein. And I'm sorry, I don't have information about how sensitive that is, but obviously if it comes back with elevated levels, then you would want to go on to more treatment. There is a test called the DAT T scan imaging. It's a single photon computerized tomography test, and you get an injection of a compound called OOP. It's a tracer, and it binds the dopamine receptors. So you literally get a head count on your dopamine receptors. And as we said, we kind of know what that number should be. So if it's less than half the number, then it's pretty clear that you're headed in that direction. This costs, if you had to pay for it out of pocket, it runs between $2,500 and $5,000. It is available at Stanford, UCSF. The Sutter Network also can get it for you, as can Kaiser. They all own hospitals, so they can do it. Generally, you'll need a neurological consult where they will use the word clinical uncertainty in the write-up. And then you go through the prior authorization, and it's your pitch on the prior auth is that there's clinical uncertainty about the possibility of cancer in this patient with REM sleep disorder. That'll get it covered by most insurance. That's a key word. Open sesame. So I'm not just scaring you to give you nothing to do about it. And we do know that there are a number of lifestyle changes that you can make. There's a Takeda protocol. I'm sorry, I don't have the reference for that. But one of my patients is in an early Parkinson's, sort of ambiguous, but probably early Parkinson's, and he's just going for it, following this protocol. And basically, it's a protocol that has you doing a lot of cardiovascular exercise, and it's enough that you would not do it. You would not start doing this if you were not a lifelong exerciser, but there's nothing like the idea of staving off Parkinson's disease to change you from a sometime exerciser to a true believer. And so this is, I think, one of many things that are emerging as far as ways of pushing back against Parkinson's disease. So maybe I'll put this aside and look at some of the new emerging therapeutics. I didn't have time today to do that as a search, but I think that could be a really good idea. We have a caller on the line who just called in. And hello, what's your name and where are you calling from?
My name is Craig. I'm calling from Santa Cruz, California.
Well, hello, Craig. What can I do for you this fine evening?
Yes, you certainly may. I caught your show on like disinfected cleansings, like you talked about apple cider vinegar and water.
Yes.
Yeah, would that be good to clean out a CPAP machine? Because I recently inquired one about a week ago, and I'll tell you, it might be helping my insomnia, but I'm not really sure how long it takes for it to take full effect before I could just kind of knock out like a rock.
Okay, so I'm sorry, CPAP we usually use for people who have sleep apnea. And
yes.
You said that you're expecting it to help your insomnia. Is that right?
Yeah, because I went and had like a sleep test by my doctor there, and they put the insurance there, and they said, I just need a CPAP machine. I have one. It's a beauty there, and I'm really glad I got it. And I tell you one thing, it does help me feel better the next day. I don't feel like I'm in like a brain fog, so I'm very happy for that aspect. And I just hope it might help me kind of like go into a deep REM sleep like you mentioned earlier.
Right. And so your question is about how often do you have to clean it? Am I understanding?
Well, I'm saying, what can you clean it with besides soap and water? Is it safe to use like apple cider vinegar and water, like say to clean up the water tank of the CPAP machine and the hoses?
I'm thinking about that most of the manufacturers have a recommended cleaning regimen, and I'm wondering, did you look in the manual for that?
Yes, it says they use like soap and water there, and it says to wash out daily and puts like the mask that goes over the face to wash that out daily with like plain old mild soap and water.
Okay, but you don't want to use soap for some reason. Help me understand.
I'll just kind of wonder which would be better. Would it be better just to use the old fashioned soap or use the vinegar? Because I heard vinegar is a really good germ killer.
It is.
Kind of wondering.
Yeah. Well, I mean, vinegar is amazing. It kills mold. It kills bacteria. It actually helps you digest your food. It's kind of it's just even if you're eating a big meal, and you know, a couple of tablespoons of apple cider vinegar dissolved in some water, like fizzy water or something, it kind of makes a nice drink, and it's really helpful for bringing up the stomach acid so you can, you know, digest the food. So you can mix the white vinegar and it's one part white vinegar and three parts warm water. And it'll, you know, you can rinse that afterwards to get rid of the vinegar scent because you won't be terribly comfortable. You want to stay away from bleach, alcohol, ammonia, or any of these sort of moisturizing, like heavy dish soaps, so anything with a heavy fragrance, anything with moisturizer, because these things can leave residues. So you want to be sure that you, if you use soap, it would be something like Dr. Bronner's Castile soap, which you can buy at every health food store in the country.
And also, organic hand soap would be fine for something like that, then, right?
If it doesn't have scent, it needs to be unscented, and it doesn't say moisturizer. Those would be the two things that could be a problem. So the main thing here is, yes, you can use vinegar and then rinse some more, and it keeps the mold out. Mold's probably the biggest danger, and you don't want to be breathing mold.
Yeah, I know that. That's a nasty thing that we've got put on this earth, I'll tell you, is mold.
Oh, no, we need mold. And if it wasn't for mold and fungi, nothing would rot. And we would basically have suffocated and drowned in the detritus of our own bodies, not to mention the trees and branches and leaves and all the other stuff that drop off onto the ground. We need that mold. It is a vital part of the let's call it the trade in atoms. You know, everything gets broken down to its constituent atoms. Did you know that you replace every atom in your body every 8 years?
No, I wasn't aware of that fact.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Have you heard of the ship of Theseus? It's really cool thing. Let me lay it on you. So you got this old Greek boat, right? That's the ship of Theseus. But it keeps going around, and it gets the wood rots, so you replace the wood, and then the masts break, so you replace the masts, and then the other wood rots, so you replace the wood. So now, after about 20 years. None of the original material are part of the ship of Theseus. So is it still the ship of Theseus? It's kind of a thought problem. Has it turned into something else, or is it still the same thing? And if the thing is not the concrete thing, then what is the thing? So it's a fun one if the CPAP fails you some night and you're having to think about something, you could think about this rather than whatever is troubling you and try to decide the dilemma of the ship of Theseus.
Mm-hmm. So I've been having like this insomnia problem for years, but I just couldn't sleep. And I tried to talk to the doctors about it, but they said I should get a sleep test there. And, and I did with the first one, but only I didn't like the doctor's opinion there, and he was, he was like my opinion more than old Uncle Grump, an officer, you might say,
Yeah.
And I think we all know who we're talking about there, because I'm surprised how that person ever got an officer, but hey, that's the mind of the voters. And
well, we will be naming no names on this program, please. All right. We try to give everybody the benefit of the doubt here. But I want you to, well, maybe except for the Secretary of Health and Human Services.
Yeah.
I'll name that name.
I'm not too on the ball. I'll put it like that,
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for the call. I hope I've helped. And keep listening.
Okay. And thank you very much for your knowledge and wisdom there. We really appreciate you. And we appreciate an honest doctor to be giving out good advice like you there. And I think you should be very honored to doing that. And I really appreciate your services. And God bless you.
God bless you back. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, we've got time for maybe one quick story. And I'm looking to see what I can hand you on that sort of a thing. Okay, here's something. I like this one. Hunting viable sperm with AI. So AI, again, bring to the rescue again. Men who were told they could never father a biological child because of low sperm count are getting a fresh shot at parenthood. A new AI model called STAR, which stands for Sperm Track and Recovery, was built at Columbia University. It hunts for vanishingly rare sperm cells in the semen of men with azoospermia, who It's inspired by the technique that astronomers use to spot new stars. So, and that's pretty cool. New potential rock stars, right, in those little sperm. Researchers created a tool that streams a sample through a channel thinner than a human hair, imaging it 300 times a second. The software will flag anything resembling a sperm, and then a little robotic arm goes in and extracts it within milliseconds. And the system is getting better and better at concentrating sperm. They've had 175 patients so far, and they've recovered sperm in 30% of cases. And at the end of last year, it produced its first baby, a girl who was born to parents who had struggled with infertility for almost 20 years. And everybody was jumping up and down. So all this effort is put into something as wonderful and special as this. And I just love the idea of this hyper-vigilant little AI, you know, with all that sort of reward stuff that, gotta find a sperm, I found one, quick, grab it. Okay, gotta find a sperm. You know, just the eternal track of vigilance to the end of actually helping men have children with their own DNA. And we can make the argument about, I make lots of arguments about this, but I see it as a good thing. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.